And now I think he's trying to clean himself up, polishing the image, triumph of the will.
There is, needless to say, a slight contradiction in Sundance magazines, or in any magazine, for example. I'd like to find out how you people politically interpret the presentation of these kind of facts. In other words, you're not approaching this from the point of view, well, isn't it outrageous that somebody is somewhat dirty-handed and a little bit tainted in American politics? And you're not approaching it from that kind of point of view that Life magazine might take of moral self-righteousness, that American politics and public life, business life should be a clean thing. And here's President Nixon who's, you know, gotten his hands messed up with all these other people. But what exactly are the politics behind running this kind of article in a magazine like Sundance?
Well, we think that the major political point is the fact of organized crime involvement in government, that it's reached such a degree that the president is involved. One interesting fact that we do have in the article is that a 1971 Internal Revenue Service report disclosed that fully 85% of the nation's gangsters, known people in organized crime, have investments in legitimate businesses. So this shows that in the business world, organized crime penetration has reached an incredible level. And in government, this couldn't have happened without a parallel infiltration, as it were, of government, because, of course, you know, regulatory agencies, zoning boards, from the local level right up to the national level, it takes a government contact for organized crime to make the kind of money, which runs to $50 billion a year, that it does. It has to have a legitimate front, or it would attract law enforcement officials who would cut it out of its activities. So probably the major political point in the article is the fact that Nixon has grown out of this milieu of organized crime, business, government entwinement. Certainly there are political alternatives to Nixon, people who aren't as entwined, but the major fact is that the entire government has been sort of, what should we say, it's spotted by the taint of organized crime.
How much do you think that links up together with the Watergate incident and the whole chain of command that is slowly being unfurled in the press about how they do business in the committee to re-elect the president, ties with the White House and all that? How much is that methodology a part of what you're talking about?
Well, there are, in the article itself, there are a number of facts tying Watergate indictees to some of the other principles in this story. That alone shows that this type of activity by Nixon's henchmen is linked up to organized crime.
A lot of the people in Watergate were involved in the Cubans for Nixon demonstrations. I mean, they're, you know, through Rebozo, of course, naturally. But, I mean, they've been very involved and interested in President Nixon, as President Nixon's been very involved and interested in reactionary Cuban politics. I mean, when he got out of law school in the 40s, Nixon wanted to go to Cuba and practice law. That's very strange. I mean, he's from Whittier, California. He wants to go to Cuba and practice law. His friendship with Rebozo, a close friendship with Batista, and Batista, is no secret, was, you know, one of the most corrupt governments around. It was a joke. The Watergate indictees Frank Sturgis and Eugenio Martinez helped plan with ex-president of Cuba, Prio Socorras, who was president in between the two Batista stints, the Cuban exile demonstrations in Miami. Bernard Barker was in the secret police of Batista, and his real estate office, Meritas, is next door to Prio Socorras' office of the Authentico Party, which is one of the Gusano parties in Miami. The thing is a mesh. I don't know how to describe it, but that is that one thing keeps running into the other, and it's totally interrelated. And I think that You know, it's the people in the Watergate incident that they've indicted that are talking to the media, to the LA Times and to the Washington Post, are very low. I mean, primarily, again, paid as bodyguards, $400 a month. I mean, they're not high-level strategists. They're just crooks. And they're involved with the master of criminals, you know.
What effect, in the eyes of the editors of Sundance Magazine, what effect do you think this printing this kind of article at this time will have, and how do you intend to get the word out further? I'm just presuming there, from what I know, that the mass media are not going to pick this up at this point off your research without going through the whole thing all over again by themselves. That's generally their trip. The Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post, Life Magazine, and to a lesser extent the New York Times have become more interested in recent years in doing investigative reporting of that nature, frequently picking it up from the underground press, thinking particularly of the case of the San Diego Street Journal. Remember all that 4 or 5 years ago printed the whole thing about Arnold Smith and San Diego and ITT, which all tied in, and finally when Life Magazine put it in, it became a big deal.
And they put it in, they cut half the story when they put it in. That was the other thing.
Cut about three quarters of the story, right. Way down. Very little of the information was actually printed.
We sent the galleys to the story to all the major press in the country, to the Times, the Washington Post, the Globe, the Post-Dispatch. I mean, all the press that would normally carry it 2 weeks ago, so that they would have time to research it and check it with their morgue files and their own sources. But it's like we don't have, you know, we're not indicting Nixon on specific guilt charges. Rather, we're uncovering his associations, evidence that's not circumstantial, but, I mean, direct, linking him in this milieu of underworld involvement. And it's evidence that shows not just a casual association with a friend, like, for instance, just through Rebozo, but in every single aspect of his life, you know, which cognates, again, with his, I think, the continuous scandals that erupt during his careers. I mean, he's so irrepressible that he can't keep everything down, he can't conceal everything. And it's like the Pentagon Papers is, I think how we compare it is, you know, most of the information in the Pentagon Papers was out years before in the underground press. And it was published, we didn't have the documents for that, but we certainly had the analysis from it, and we had, you know, verbal sources elsewhere. When Jeff did this article, he went around and talked to many of these people in personal interviews, you know, who thought he was a friend from Miami or a friend from Las Vegas. And that, you know, they were somewhat free, freer than you would suspect ex-FBI agents, for instance, would be with information. But it's not something that they readily conceal. It's not like having a photograph of Nixon with Rebozo's mistress in Key Biscayne, something like that. You know, there's no check stubs, there's no fingerprints. It's just a mass of evidence. It's overwhelming. It takes that plus the analysis of organized crime, totally interwoven into every aspect of the society, that one reaches the conclusion of the article, the conclusion of our verdict. I don't think it'll have a tremendous impact on the election unless the media chooses to run with it, and it's their choice. And media is not based upon investigation analysis, primarily because, I guess, of vested interests, but also because it's boring. I mean, it's hard to go through all this and essentially have to be a speed freak and get into the relationships. But that's where the government is understood to work. That's the mechanism.
Yeah, I was going to say that the article in Sundance Magazine is, among other things, extremely boring. But it's
beautiful graphics. I mean, you can look at the graphics in the subheads.
I don't mean to put it down by saying that, you know, you could have livened it up to a 1,000-word article and it wouldn't have meant anything. You know, you could have just said, this man is a crook, and like, he's associated with a bunch of crooks, and here's a picture of him looking like a pig and goodbye. But that obviously wasn't the way this article was put together. It's a very thorough job. And, you know, something you were saying a minute ago, I was struck by the fact that the major mass media are undergoing a certain change. I don't know why it is. I can speculate about why it is. For example, the Segretti piece that the Washington Post came out with. I had the entire thing here a few weeks ago, and I read it on the air, the entire Washington Post version, not the part that was reprinted in the Chronicle. And in that, they didn't have check stubs and photographs all they had was the word that they obviously felt was strong enough of a couple of former associates who blew the whistle on this guy, and they went with it in a story that could have easily, you know, if they were at all fearful, have gotten them into trouble. The New York Times, I don't think, would ever go with anything like that still. And
but, you know, well, Jack Anderson broke. Why? Because they ran with that story of Agnew being involved in shady real estate deals in Maryland, which proved to be false, and which Anderson claims led to the suppression or the attempted suppression of the media by Nixon. I mean, they're very weary. In fact, I don't want to say who, but a person that's very close to, was a member of the Times and very close to organized crime, you know, expressed that privately to a third party that one of the reasons that the Times would probably not touch this story is because of that. They don't want to get involved with Nixon. I mean, it's obvious that Nixon, you know, Times is a pro-McGovern paper, represents 55%, in fact, of the total circulation of all papers that support McGovern. And the Post is a very good paper, and then it's Morton Mintz and people on there, and real investigative journalism, but it's hard. I mean, the Newspaper Preservation Act is one reason, is they don't, papers don't want to break their monopoly. Why should they antagonize the administration?
So
they have to.
So far, except for local media here in the Bay Area, and we're not even sure about that yet, we know that KQED Television and KPFA Radio have responded by putting you on the air, but we don't even know how the Chronicle or the Examiner or newspapers like that will respond to this kind of story, and the wire services, too, may not pick it up.
We'll know in a few days. I mean, our strategy was to stick our finger where the holes were and start from there.
There has been, you know, curiously, it sort of passed people's notice and was regarded a freaky thing, but both Scanlon's, which was effectively put out of business by the government action, and Rampart's, which almost was on the story about the telephone company with the credit cards a few months ago, have been victims of what you really could call government censorship exercised in a kind of a roundabout way, but it hurt them, or at least corporate pressure or something, economic pressure that hurt them. How did Sundance feel when you went into publishing an article called Nixon and the Mafia? Did you have any thoughts about the $12.4 million lawsuit against Look Magazine?
Well, Look Magazine was owned by Cowles, and Cowles was a millionaire. Sundance is owned by the staff, and we're dirt poor. Furthermore, we distributed ourselves, and some of the places are straight distributors, and other places are freak distributors. And, I mean, we're not frightened or intimidated from pressure. I mean, we get the magazine out even if we did distribute it ourselves personally. And our printers have been, you know, are very good at it. And, of course, if they wouldn't print it, we'd have it printed elsewhere. I mean, we would get it out. Sort of a guerrilla operation, you know, and we have a lot of more mobility than Rampart's. Rampart's was being printed by a very reactionary printer in Phoenix, I believe it was.
Right, something like that.
Right, and they've applied pressure directly at the point of distribution, which I think was PDC, and they threatened to sue PDC and then all their wholesalers independently.
PDC, for those who don't know, is Publishers Distributing Corporation or something like that. Let's get back to the article and talk a little more about that, because a lot of people out there probably won't have access to it. The article Nixon and the Mafia, which I read, one of the things that was most interesting to me about it is you always read, you know, you read the straight press and President Nixon goes to Florida and they say, you know, Nixon had dinner with industrialist Baby Rebozo, and the adjectives that they used to qualify a few of, you know, and political figures such as, you know, and then all these non-quality adjectives. And in this article you find out exactly who those industrialists and political figures actually are. And it gives a very interesting and, I think, deep interpretation of the kind of world that Nixon comes from. David, why don't you go into that a little bit about the whole group of people that he associates with?
Well, some of these people have had, or are shown in the article, that have had links with organized crime through various banks and so-called legitimate businesses in the southern Florida area. When Mr. Nixon goes down there to yacht with these people or visit with them or play golf or whatever, he's playing golf or yachting with people who have made millions of dollars. Baby Rebozo, as we talked about earlier, and war profiteering and retreading tires. Some of these people were associated with the Miami National Bank. One of them was William Palat, He was a director and a chief executive officer from 1959 to 1963. Well, during this time, the bank passed from control of Mary Lansky, who is often referred to as the finance minister of organized crime, or the high priest of organized crime, or whatever. He's really a mafia kingpin to Jimmy Hoffa and the Teamsters. And both of these have been, well, obviously Lansky was corrupt, and the Teamsters too had many links with organized crime. And so Palat clearly was associated in a very direct way with an institution that was being used extensively by organized crime to launder money. By laundering, I mean making seem to be legitimate money that was coming from illicit operations such as narcotics. Other people, Palat, by the way, is linked to Nixon not only on a personal friendship basis, but he was the Florida chapter, he headed the Florida chapter of the United Citizens for Nixon Agnew in 1968.
One thing about the bank, Miami National is the chief creditor in a $300 million lawsuit against Nixon's law firm.
Other people like Palat, Lou Chesler, who I mentioned contributed $14,000 to Nixon's 1960 campaign, has had close associations with Lansky. Also, Chesler and his acquaintance Donald Berg, who was the man who sold Nixon his lots on Key Biscayne, are shown in the article, they're too numerous to go into now, many links with different figures in organized crime. Daniel Ludwig, who's a millionaire or a billionaire, who dredged the Bahamian harbor for Lansky frontman Wallace Groves and built a casino in the Bahamas and leased it to other Lansky frontmen, Sam Cohen and Morris Landsberg. He's a long-time client of Nixon's New York law firm. Tex McCrary, who worked on the 52 Eisenhower-Nixon campaign and the 1960 Nixon campaign as a PR man, also served as a PR man for some of Lansky's Bahamian business interests. So all of these men who have been close to Nixon in either a personal or a business sense have links to organized crime.
Did you mention Nathan Ratner? He was the original broker for Nixon's real estate venture in Fisher Island. Ratner was also a broker for Kai's Realty, which handled the property in Key Biscayne, which Rebozo bought and which the Florida White House now sits, as does Harold Janine in the ITT compound. Ratner also owned shares in the Bank of Miami Beach. In the Bank of Miami Beach, it was used in the Havana Connection, which skimmed illicit gambling funds and underworld money from Cuba into Miami in cash. And I don't know, it's just...
There's lots of others. There's William Sapphire, who was one of Nixon's trusted speechwriters, and Julie Nixon's... the book Nixon Family Photographs that recently came out. Sapphire worked on that.
Max Courtney was a Lansky lieutenant, actually testified under oath that Nixon was a client in his bookmaking operation. These things have come out. They've never been substantiated, but the article, if you want to go through it and really get heavy, hooks Nixon into about 12 different, at least, proximities with bookmaking, where he's been actually identified twice. But again, there's never been any substantiating information from other sources. But Courtney was one of the better ones. His own advisor, security advisor James Golden, became head of the security at Resorts International, which bought Mary Carter Paint, which owns two casinos in the Bahamas, in which Lansky, there's a lot of Lansky activity tied up to. There's also a rumor that Nixon owned stock in Resorts International. We weren't able to verify that. There's also a rumor that that Lansky does too, but that's never been verified. What has been verified, though, is a former Republican presidential candidate, Thomas E. Dewey, does own stock in it.
the obvious question to ask about all this material is with a political campaign going on right now and Senator McGovern making increasingly an issue of what he calls the most corrupt administration in the last 100 years. Is this information available to the McGovern campaign, and have you received any reaction that they're going to be able to, that they will do anything with it?
Well, this definitely fits into what McGovern has been saying, and the information is verifiable. In other words, we do have documents and proof of any allegations that are made in the article. So it's available certainly for use by McGovern if he chooses. It is, of course, difficult to make a campaign issue out of information like this. This type of material is by nature complicated. As you said earlier, it's difficult to get through the story because the links take time to understand. And also, I think it's difficult for us as a layman or whatever to understand the intricacies of organized crime operations. It's difficult for us to understand the way that money is laundered through banks, for instance, the way that real estate deals are conducted so that speculators make money. A zoning ordinance suddenly gets changed and somebody makes $2 million, or a causeway is built to an island and the men who speculated in land suddenly are all millionaires. That's what happened in Fish Island, for instance.
Miami Beach just reeks of that when you're down there. You just feel that the very ground under you is just, the sidewalks are paved with rotten deals and just exploitation right and left. I spent too much time there this summer. I never want to see it again, but you do very much pick up that vibration, and from talking to people down the scene down there, you know, it seems like there's not only a skeleton in every closet, but one underneath every paving stone.
And despite the fact that Nixon, of course, was born and first was a senator from California, and that while he wasn't in public office, he was a lawyer in New York, California, and then New York. He has long had very close ties with those people in Miami who are responsible for the corruption you just mentioned. Specifically, of course, Key Biscayne. Nixon essentially put Key Biscayne on the map. People had never heard of it. Well, Nixon's been involved in Key Biscayne for a long time. And the other people, such as Baby Rebozo, George Smathers, and various politicians and businessmen in Southern Florida that have also been involved in Key Biscayne, are very much connected to this whole web of corruption that you're talking about.
That was Larry Bensky talking with David Weir and Craig Pies of Sundance Magazine about an article in the current issue entitled Nixon and the Mafia. You're tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial radio in New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM. And the program scheduled to be heard at this time, the Chicago conspiracy trial, is unavailable for broadcast this afternoon. So in its place, we hear the following.
The Truman presidency from 1945 through 1952 was a crucial period in 20th century American history. It was during these years that America's present international involvements took shape. It was also during this time that the major power relationships which still persist in terms of East and West became immutable realities. At home, Truman was president during the period of readjustment following the greatest military political event the country ever knew, World War II. We're going to spend the next hour assessing his performance in office. Much of what became Truman's foreign policy was inherited from Roosevelt. It was April 12, 1945, that Harry S. Truman became the 33rd President of the United States.
Wilderness Road, adventure on the American frontier with the Weston family and Dan'l Boone in the exciting days following the American Revolution.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin from CBS World News. A press association has just announced that President Roosevelt is dead. The president died of a cerebral hemorrhage. All we know so far is that the president died at Warm Springs in Georgia.
The drums are wrapped in black crepe and are muffled, as you can hear. And the pace of the musicians is so slow. And behind them, these are Navy boys. And now just coming past the treasury, I can see the horses drawing the caisson. And most generally, folks having as tough a time as I am trying to see it. And behind us is the car bearing the man on whose shoulders now falls the terrific burdens and responsibilities that were handled so well by the man to whose body we're paying our last respects now. God bless him, President Truman.
Just a moment. Let me present you, will you, Harry?
Members of the Congress, I have the great pleasure and the high privilege of presenting to you the President of the United States.
Mr. Speaker, Mr. President, members of the Congress, it is with a heavy heart that I stand before you, my friends and colleagues in the Congress of the United States. In the memory of those who have made the supreme sacrifice, in the memory of our fallen president, we shall not fail.
It was less than a month later, on May 8, 1945, that Nazi Germany surrendered to the Allies.
I only wish that Franklin D. Roosevelt had lived to witness this day. General Eisenhower informs me that the forces of Germany have surrendered to the United Nations. The flags of freedom fly all over Europe.
The difficulties between the Soviets and the Western Three, the Americans, the British, and their clients, the French, began even before the peace was concluded. Essentially, the problem was over the future of Eastern Europe, and it is here that the roots of the Cold War and militant American anti-communism in the post-war period are to be found. Stalin met with Churchill and FDR at Yalta in early 1945 and established agreements on the new governments in the East. They were described as free governments. By July, when the Allies met again at Potsdam, the definition of those governments was the cause of friction. Stalin had made his position clear somewhat earlier. In a letter to Truman in late April, he wrote, concerning the Polish government, "You apparently do not agree that the Soviet Union has a right to make efforts that there should exist in Poland a government friendly toward the Soviet Union, and that the Soviet government cannot agree to existence in Poland of a government hostile to it. Besides everything else, this is demanded by the blood of the Soviet people abundantly shed on the fields of Poland in the name of the liberation of Poland. I do not know whether there has been established in Greece a really representative government, and whether the government in Belgium is really democratic. The Soviet Union was not consulted when these governments were being established there. The Soviet government did not lay claim to interference in these affairs, as it understands the whole importance of Belgium and Greece for the security of Great Britain. It is not clear why, while the question of Poland is discussed, it is not wanted to take into consideration the interests of the Soviet Union from the point of view of its security." Stalin's position in the matter is quite clear. He demands a sphere of influence for the Soviets in Eastern Europe. It was this demand that Truman refused to accept. On the one hand stood the absence of free elections and Western-style democratic processes in rebuilding the politics of the Eastern European states, Romania, Poland, Bulgaria. On the other hand, the Soviets felt need to establish a buffer zone on their western frontier. By 1947, the situation had hardened to an extent that precipitated direct American involvement. The arena was Greece, where an insurrection, including but not always dominated by communists, where an insurrection threatened the royalist government. The British had aided the government, but in 1947, with their own economy a shambles, the British pulled out. Greece's strategic position in the Eastern Mediterranean acted as a magnet, and the United States stepped in. The statement of America's position became known as the Truman Doctrine. In his memoirs, Truman wrote, "Greece needed aid, and needed it quickly, and in substantial amounts. The alternative was the loss of Greece and the extension of the Iron Curtain across the eastern Mediterranean. If Greece was lost, Turkey would become an untenable outpost in a sea of communism. "I believe," Truman said in his speech to Congress, "that we must assist free peoples who are resisting attempted subjugation by armed minorities or by outside pressures." Congress voted military aid, $250 million for Greece, $150 million for Turkey.
A number of policymakers